Welcome to another edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. This weekend, before Super Tuesday, on the program...
Will Arkansas punch above its weight on Super Tuesday, providing a symbolic victory for anyone not named Trump?
How do the economic plans of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton impact Arkansas, where the gap in wealth inequality is wide?
Money is flowing into two races for the state Supreme Court, but what of the candidates themselves?
Long shots take their chances, aiming to unseat Republican incumbents in the U.S. Senate and the 2nd Congressional District.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And this is KUAR's Week in Review. Arkansas is improbably occupying a station above its delegate worth in the eyes of many presidential candidates. The primary is just a few days away now, Tuesday, and we have not one, not two, but Trump, Rubio, Cruz, and Clinton crisscrossing the state this weekend, Michael. The stakes are high for anyone, especially besides Trump in the GOP field, to finally have a win, and tiny little Arkansas might give them that kind of room. So Michael, Rubio signaled as much right after his second place finish in South Carolina. He came to Arkansas, and you were there.
Right. On Sunday, he spoke to about 2,000 people at the State House Convention Center. And you're right, it really is amazing to actually see Arkansas get this kind of attention from presidential candidates. And to a degree, it shows that the state still is up for grabs. The most recent polling showed Donald Trump on top. That was from Talk Business and Hendricks College. But with Ted Cruz to come to Arkansas to campaign in Central and Northwest Arkansas Sunday, Trump and Rubio both to campaign in Bentonville Saturday, and Rubio coming back Monday, Hillary Clinton, as you said, to a campaign in Pine Bluff on Sunday. Just incredible, and shows that moving the primary up last year did make a difference, the action by the legislature moving it from May to March. But back to Rubio's first stop in Arkansas on Sunday. He really energized the crowd, and it comes at a time when a lot of establishment Republicans are really working to rally people behind someone other than Donald Trump. And here's a segment from Rubio speaking to the audience there and really saying that the party needs to be unified, and that he believes he's the person who can do that.
We are headed in the wrong direction, and here is the bad news, because we have to be realistic about our challenges. Here's the bad news. If we stay on the road we are on right now, if we keep doing in Washington what is happening right now, then we are going to be the first Americans in our history that leave their kids worse off than themselves. That's never happened. And that's why we can't lose this election. That's why 2016 is an election we have to win. And that's why I'm asking you for your vote, because if you nominate me, we will beat the Democrats, we will defeat them in 2016, and we have a chance to turn America around. The Democrats know this, by the way. Polo, polo. No, don't say polo. The Democrats know this. They attack me more than any other Republican in this race, because they know that if I'm our nominee, we win. Why? Because number one, I'm going to unify this party when I'm our nominee. We have to come together. Look, if we're still fighting against each other in July, in August, in September, in October, we will lose. We have our differences. We don't have to agree on everything. But we better be together or we're going to lose. We will unify this party. And we won't just unify it. We will grow it. We are going to take the conservative message and the conservative movement to millions of Americans that have never voted for us before.
And a lot of people there in the audience that day really didn't know a lot about Marco Rubio. He's still a fresh face to a lot of Arkansans. And I talked to people who had come out just because they wanted to learn more about him, don't know him too much, and some were saying they still don't know who they're going to vote for. And so I think it really is important at this point for the candidates to get to Arkansas, because a lot of people still not really sure. Mike Huckabee, of course, had so much support in the state that him getting out of the race a few weeks ago, and then Jeb Bush getting out of the race after South Carolina, that's really left a lot of Arkansans not sure who to back.
I know to some degree this is you know, Marco Rubio is his typical stump speech. He did have some Arkansas-centric kind of remarks in there, but was there any policy discussion, or is it mostly just he was selling himself as the guy that can really unify the Republican Party to kind of, he didn't say Donald Trump, I guess, but to defeat Donald Trump?
Yeah, he did not actually say the names of his Republican opponents at all during that rally. He repeatedly, though, brought up Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, so that's part of the effort to give the appearance of you're already the front runner. You don't even need to acknowledge your opponents. He did reference them, though, by he talked about his background, the fact that his parents came from Cuba, moved to Florida. His father worked at a Miami Beach hotel as a bartender. His mom was a maid. And he pointed out that it's unique to have the possibility of someone with that background rather than having the son of a former president or the son of a millionaire, making some little jabs there at Donald Trump and Jeb Bush.
And you mentioned the crowd's response a little bit. A lot of people maybe weren't totally familiar with Marco Rubio. They're curious about it. A lot of people, State House Convention Center in downtown Little Rock, I saw estimates between 1,000 and 2,000 people. It seems like a pretty big event. We've had a crowd around 7,000 or 9,000 for Donald Trump, but still, it was a packed room, wasn't it?
It was definitely a packed room. A lot of people coming out there to hear him.
And after this rally with Marco Rubio, perhaps a little bit more in his favor carrying the state, Governor Asa Hutchinson, who is one of those former Huckabee backers, he made his endorsement of Marco Rubio, one of the last big catches from the state to really endorse someone. You got the chance to listen to the governor give a talk with NPR's All Things Considered, part of a nationally aired broadcast.
Yeah, NPR had approached the Governor Asa Hutchinson about talking about why he was supporting Marco Rubio, and I was in there. I engineered recording it from this end for NPR, so sat in there. And an extremely interesting interview, largely because the governor really went on the attack against Donald Trump. Not even so much here selling Marco Rubio, though granted to a degree, it was him following the line of questioning from NPR's Robert Siegel, but some very pointed criticism of Donald Trump that went out to a national audience. This was on Wednesday's All Things Considered. So let's listen to that four-minute segment that was aired nationwide.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. After Donald Trump's victory in last night's Nevada caucuses, the campaigns for the Republican presidential nomination now look ahead to Super Tuesday. March 1st is the single biggest day of primary voting and caucusing. And on the Republican side, we'll see results from 11 states, including Arkansas. Asa Hutchinson is the governor of Arkansas. He's a Republican. And he joins us now from the state capitol in Little Rock. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
On Monday, you endorsed Senator Marco Rubio for president. But so far, Senator Rubio hasn't won a primary or a caucus. In light of that, why should he be the nominee? And does he really stand a chance?
Well, we certainly hope Arkansas will be the first state that he outright wins. And it is important to win the primary states. But what has happened to Senator Rubio is that he has came back from New Hampshire. He was a strong showing in South Carolina. Trump is a juggernaut that is difficult to unravel at this point. But I think Marco Rubio is the right one to do it. I think he can win Arkansas. And he can win in November.
But there seems to be a coalescing of thought among Republican office holders and state party chairs that there might be a problem with the Trump candidacy. But primary voters don't seem to see that. They seem to be drawn to this man, and he's doing remarkably well.
He is, and he's getting better, you know, in terms of being more disciplined in his approach. But I'm not sure anybody is clear where he is philosophically.
Are you clear that he's a Republican?
Well, he's running as a Republican, and I intend to support the Republican nominee, but I'm concerned about trade policy, and I don't believe raising tariffs is the right direction to go. I think it would hurt us in Arkansas in terms of job creation. Whenever you look at promising positions that looks totally undoable and unwise, it's hard to figure where that goes in terms of leadership.
What do you say to the argument that what Donald Trump has done in the primary season this year builds upon the success of the Tea Party, the role of Sarah Palin on the national ticket in 2008, that the Republican Party has been courting an angry electorate for quite a few years now, and here's the payoff.
Well, there's some merit to that. Republican base has been increasingly frustrated with progress in Washington. Everybody should be responding to that, but we have to respond with leadership, with good temperament. We have to also, as leaders, help educate the public as to what's the right ideas, what is the right thing that we're going to replace Obamacare with, what's the right direction for our country in terms of security. And these are serious discussions. They're not salesmanship. It's not a circus atmosphere. You know, these are serious discussions as to the direction of really the free world.
You find the Trump a discussion of these things to be not serious. I mean, when you say a circus atmosphere, I assume you're referring to the Trump campaign.
I do not see his discussion of issues as serious. The words are frightening. How you're going to build a wall, how you're going to have Mexico pay for it. What does this mean? Let's be realistic in our discussions and how we discuss these issues with the American people.
For most of last year, the read on the Republican primary season was that primary voters might have a summer fling in the polls with Donald Trump, but you know, they'd get serious come the fall or come the winter. It's almost spring right now. Are you now reconciled to the fact that Trump is a very, very serious contender, the front runner for the Republican nomination, and that the party isn't going to suddenly become disillusioned with him and get serious and say, oh, we need a governor instead?
Well, I think it's very serious, and the potential for him winning the nomination is more than just a possibility. It is a potential, and certainly it was underestimated his strength. We underestimated the frustration of the American voters and his long-lasting candidacy. So we'll see if it's not too late to change. I wanted to add my voice to it. That's why I saw Marco Rubio as the right alternative and the right one that can win in November. I hope that voice makes a difference.
Governor Asa Hutchinson, Republican of Arkansas, thanks for talking with us today.
Hey, thank you. Great to be with you.
So I think this is in part efforts by the establishment Republicans to really coalesce behind someone other than Donald Trump. And he really... you don't get someone more establishment, really, than Governor Hutchinson. He's been running for office as for decades as a Republican, served in many different positions with the Drug Enforcement Administration and Department of Homeland Security under President George W. Bush. But as he said, is it too late? It might be. It would be tough for someone to, even if everyone can rally behind one candidate, and you still have kind of a split between Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, it would be tough even if everyone got behind one candidate other than Donald Trump to change the momentum at this point.
And the other big question is, so Rubio's got the establishment endorsement. So what? He got it in South Carolina. He still didn't win. He also got in Tennessee today, too, another Super Tuesday state. You talked with Greg Shufelt a little bit today, actually. I don't know if you got too much of time to digest it yet, but what does he make of these establishment endorsements in a year when Republican voters don't like the establishment?
Well, Shufelt said that he does think that there is the potential for Marco Rubio to win in Arkansas, just given the number of endorsements, especially from the governor. And he thinks that this state really is up for grabs. But whether or not the establishment getting behind someone, it remains to be seen. There are so many people who are excited by Donald Trump, obviously, because he's saying the things that a lot of people in Arkansas have been feeling for quite a while and feel like Republicans should have fought harder against President Obama, as the governor said there. he has very effectively tapped into the anger that a lot of people are feeling.
All right, Michael, thanks for going out this Sunday. Not a normal work day for us necessarily, covering the Rubio rally. And next Sunday, we'll have some coverage from the other side of the field. You'll be at Hillary Clinton's rally in Pine Bluff.
Yeah, should be interesting. And you'll be covering Ted Cruz here in the central Arkansas area. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. And wow, can't wait to hear how things finalized by the time our next podcast comes out.
What will we talk about when this is over for the next one? All right, well, thanks a lot, Michael.
Thanks.
So that was KUAR's Michael Hiblin. He joined us for a segment recorded early in the week, specifically on the Republican presidential primary. Since then, we've had a few more updates. Governor Asa Hutchinson will campaign with Marco Rubio on Monday in Conway. Now, let's look at the Democratic race a little bit. Sarah, you talked to both campaigns, and you tried to focus really on some sort of issues-based story instead of just the horse race and polling and who's doing what in the campaign. What did you look at?
Well, Jacob, polls show that the economy is the number one issue of importance to Arkansas voters. And in this Democratic primary, for listeners who've been following the debates, both candidates have argued about what it means to be progressive, who's more convicted to their ideals, and whose plans are more practical. So I took a look at, you know, given that Arkansas is one of the poorest states in the country, what is the difference between these two candidates, and what difference might their economic programs make to resolve wealth disparities in this state?
Well, what's the answer?
Well, I spoke with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, State Campaign Director Sarah Scanlon, and she said for Sanders, it's about engaging the grassroots, and that's what's going to make his ambitious plans possible, because he's bringing out a new electorate and he's changing the nature of politics in this country. And she said his first priority is to address the growing wealth disparity that he believes has not been larger in this country since the 1920s.
We have three of the largest employers in this country are located in this state. And those employers at the top level are making a lot of money. The employees who get up in the morning, get up at late at night, work all day, are not seeing their income grow.
So he's referring to she's referring to Walmart and Tyson and companies like that.
Right. She said, you know, that Arkansas has some of these largest employers in the nation here. So she used that example. And I also spoke with Hillary Clinton's senior policy advisor, Anne O'Leary, who is visiting the state for all of 24 hours. And she said that former Secretary of State and Senator Clinton is focused on children and women and has been for her whole career, and that she sees the issue of tackling poverty in states like Arkansas as being beyond just this issue of wages and taxation.
Of course we need to tax the wealthy. Of course we need to be much more aggressive. And she has very specific plans on how she's going to do that. But she also makes clear that that can't be the only answer. We also need to have economic development in distressed communities. We need to have opportunities for education. We need to have a comprehensive plan.
So I spoke with several academics about comparing the two of them, and University of Arkansas at Little Rock economist Sarah Quintanar said that she did notice that Sanders' plan to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, the federal minimum wage, could possibly impact 500,000 Arkansans who fall between the $12 an hour that Senator Clinton is proposing at the federal level and the $15 an hour that Senator Sanders is, although Clinton's senior policy advisor O'Leary did tell me that she would support any local communities getting up to that $15 an hour. But of course, here in Arkansas, the state just raised the minimum wage to $8.50. And the concern on the Clinton camp is that that might impact job growth.
Of course, that was overwhelmingly approved by voters, the idea to raise the minimum wage. That was a number that a lot of people agreed upon. It left some people in that campaign wondering if they could have asked for more because of the support was so massive, to the point where even Tom Cotton, who's traditionally against minimum wages and things like that, was for it, and so was Governor Asa Hutchinson. Before we end on this topic, though, Hillary Clinton's pretty much guaranteed shoe-in she's going to win Arkansas. Is that right?
Well, the Talk Business and Politics and Hendricks College poll shows her leading with 57% of the state. And Sanders has 25%, 18% are undecided, and that's as of February 7th. You know, I spoke with a political scientist at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, and he said that Arkansans tend to vote based on regional relationships, and that Hillary Clinton still has those longstanding ties here that she developed as
First Lady. Yeah.
First Lady.
Yeah, well, certainly all the Democratic establishment, or what's left of them anyway, they've come out of the woodwork in support for her. But Karen Trico Stewart had a report also this week for us. They got some national traction. NPR retweeted it anyway, showing that based on that Talk Business report, that among millennials, while Hillary Clinton wins many Arkansas categories because of those ties, millennials who maybe don't have any experience with her being First Lady or have any memory of Bill Clinton being governor, they are neck and neck with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And Sanders, I think, has won about 80% of millennials in all the other contests. So that's the only area in Arkansas where he seems to have a little bit of traction. Okay, another issue that, you know, maybe the most important race is directly for Arkansas voters. It's not in the political sphere, although it, for some it seems to be, depending on what advertisement you're looking at. Chris, you've looked at two different state races for the highest court in the state.
Yeah, that's right. There are two. One is for an associate justice position on the state Supreme Court, and the other is for the chief justice position. For the associate justice position, we've got a Little Rock lawyer, Clark Mason, who's been practicing law in the state for about 30 years. He's running for it. And on the other side, you've got Sean Womack, who's a circuit judge and a former Republican state lawmaker, former state legislator.
We know a lot about his politics. He's certainly a very conservative guy.
Yeah, certainly. A lot of reports have noted that when he was in the legislature, he supported a bill that would reinstate a ban on gay parents seeking adoptions, or a state, you know, seeking a, you know, state supported adoption process for gay parents. He points out that, well, you know, out of the thousands of bills that he potentially, you know, supported, or hundreds that he was the primary sponsor on, this one piece of legislation came out of the woodwork. But he is not, clearly,
he hasn't renounced it, though.
He has not renounced it, no. Saying basically that, you know, he's just kind of reformatting the language of the law to so that it would be potentially constitutional. However, he does clearly have the endorsements of several Republican state officials, Rick Crawford and a congressman from the 1st District, and Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin have both endorsed him. He, as far as his judicial philosophy goes and things like that, I mean, he's of course been a circuit judge for about 8 years now, but he basically says that his policymaking background in the legislature gives him a leg up, is what he terms it, on understanding how laws are crafted. So therefore, he can be a better interpreter of what a law means when it is called into question before his court. And that, you know, and he
which interestingly is kind of the opposite of Antonin Scalia's philosophy, which is based on it has to only be the text, legislative intent. We can't know that.
Right, but right.
Anyway,
yeah,
he
yeah.
probably wouldn't say that. He'd probably say he likes Antonin Scalia.
Maybe. I didn't ask him if he did. Of course, you know, the former U.S. Supreme Court justice recently passed away and received a lot of tributes from current sitting justices on the Supreme Court. A lot of folks have tweeted out, you know, that they met him and were honored to meet him and, you know, kind of study his opinions and whatnot. As far as the other candidate in that race, Clark Mason, he had been appointed a special justice on the Supreme Court by former Democratic Governor Mike Beebe, who also recently endorsed him. Clark Mason's law firm has been noted for litigating in a lot of like wrongful death lawsuits, nursing home neglect cases on the part of on behalf of the patient. He's also represented a lot of small farmers who have filed lawsuits against big like agribusinesses like Monsanto. And he, you know, in both cases, you know, it's obviously it's a nonpartisan race officially, but in both cases, they clearly have a what you would call a sort of gray kind of partisan divide. You know, Womack clearly lines up with more Republican-leaning folks. Mason is more on the Democratic side. there was some reports that noted that Mason had donated something like $20,000 to Democratic campaigns since 2001. So that gives you an idea of where...
Not a Clinton-era holdover or something.
Yeah, alliance politically. But in both cases, I mean, they both say that, well, we're here to interpret the law and, you know, we use the facts before us in the case. And they tried to emphasize that they're not biased. So that's the associate justice race.
And now the big race, the big ticket really on the ballot.
Yeah, it's the Chief Justice race to replace outgoing Special Appointed Justice Howard Brill, who's not seeking election after he was appointed to, after Chief Justice Jim Hanna resigned. And unfortunately, Jim Hanna is now deceased. In that race, there's been more than $1 million in spending, more than half of which has come from an outside group, the Judicial Crisis Network.
This is that so-called dark money where you don't know all information about the donors. Usually comes from out of state, like this group is in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, they're based in Washington, D.C. They've been sending out mailers, running TV ads, attacking who is now Associate Justice Courtney Goodson. She's running against Circuit Judge Dan Kemp from Mountain Home.
Attacking her for things, like I heard one about how she took a... Italian yacht cruise or something. It was a gift. It's something.
Yeah, a personal gift from the friend of her now husband, John Goodson, who's a class action lawyer, who's come under a lot of scrutiny for himself and his law firm has recently, just because that controversy kind of stems from the kind of payouts that the legal representatives get on behalf of their clients when they win those cases. And there have been some reports that they have been going and entering their cases in circuit courts that have judges that may be partial to them, essentially is the implication. But aside from that, Courtney Goodson, I had been trying for a couple of weeks to get an interview with her. She just sent me, as we record this, email or recorded responses to some emailed questions. And in it, I asked her about her judicial philosophy, for instance. She calls herself a strict constructionist, which is more along those lines of the Scalia, although he is, what's the term, originalist. But a constructionist being someone who interprets the law as it's written down. She, you know, has been very vehement in calling in trying to get her opponent Dan Kemp to decry these ads by the Judicial Crisis Network. And I asked her, you know, in terms of like what kind of ethical reforms she would like to see. Mainly, she would like to see ones that basically she'd like to see more disclosure for these
campaign finance kind of things.
Yeah. Dan Kemp, he's also proposed a series of ethical reforms. Mainly, he wants to eliminate all personal gifts for judges. And he would also like to see more funding for the state public defender system. He'd like to see drug courts in every county of the state. As we record this, it's kind of been recent news that he has been under some scrutiny lately by liberal blogger and attorney Matt Campbell of the Blue Hog Report, who's filed an ethics complaint against him, basically alleging that Kemp unethically accepted a guilty plea on behalf of the daughter of some family friends when he was a judge. And that's sort of still developing, that story.
They contributed to his campaign.
Yeah, that's the latest, development. Whether or not that will sway the race at all remains to be seen. There are a couple of congressional races that you covered this week. One is in the House, one is in the Senate. In both cases, you've got an incumbent who's been there for, a while. Well, in the case of French Hill, he's...
First term, but he's been in Washington before in other capacities.
Right. And Senator John Bozeman, kind of well-entrenched, if not having the same kind of name recognition, but they have kind of far-right opponents in both cases. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, first let's look at the U.S. Senate race between Curtis Coleman and John Bozeman. And Curtis Coleman, he's kind of one of those perennial candidates, it seems like. He actually ran against Bozeman for the same seat in 2010 in an eight-way primary, where Bozeman was so successful that he got a majority without a runoff in an eight-way field, which Jeanine Perry at the University of Arkansas, political scientist, thought was pretty remarkable and kind of showed that, well, Coleman might be making the argument that Bozeman isn't conservative enough, that voters don't really seem to buy it. They think he's pretty much a rank-and-file kind of conservative guy, even if he's not as fiery. But here's Curtis Coleman. I talked to him this week. This was his major complaint. It was about these so-called shutdown votes, cromnibus bills that include things like Planned Parenthood and some funding measures you might not like if you're a Republican.
Yeah, well, you know, my position on that is, why am I being blamed for shutting down the government? I mean, Democrats on the other side of the aisle are at least as obstinate and obstructionist as I am, if not more. I mean, why weren't they willing to capitulate? Why weren't they willing to move a little bit to keep from shutting down the government? I think this idea that a Republican is responsible for shutting down the government and not a Democrat is ludicrous. And I think Republicans too often begin from a position, it looks like, of surrender and capitulation. I think if conservative Republicans would develop the reputation of standing firm and strong on basic fundamental principles, and it was known from the beginning they weren't going to budge on that, I think we'd see a different kind of vote happen in the Senate.
And Bozeman, of course, says that pretty much, given any issue, that they have the same kind of conservative principles. They both believe that the national debt is one of the major problems facing the country. But Bozeman, the answer was a little bit more on the, I guess he would say it, more practical side.
Well, I did vote to increase the debt ceiling on occasion when I was in the House. I was elected in 2001, right after 9/11. And so immediately we became a nation at war. We're fighting two wars and really felt like, you know, that was the right thing to do. In regard, since I've been in the Senate, I voted for a debt ceiling increase, but in return for that, we got one of the biggest decreases in spending in decades. And that's really what it's all about. For the first time, we got, for every dollar increase, we got a dollar decrease. So that's what you want to accomplish, you know, with those kind of things. Because the reality is that the debt ceiling has to be increased, or you'd be in a situation where the stock market would tank and all of those kind of things, the government shut down, and really nobody wants that.
So that's kind of the big issues there, is who's more conservative, even though their goals might be the same, how to achieve them. The establishment all behind John Bozeman, no one has really come out for Curtis Coleman from elected officials. The big endorsements like the NRA, Right to Life, those are behind John Bozeman as well. They think he's plenty conservative. I just wanted to play one more kind of oddball excerpt from the interview. I didn't put it in a piece that aired this week. Curtis Coleman believes that there are active terrorist training camps in the United States. Did you just say that there are ISIS training camps in the United States?
Well, there are terrorist training camps in the United States. There is documentation that there are terrorist training camps, and that's been publicized on mainstream media.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
I don't have the details. I don't know how many of those there are. I've just seen the report. I haven't committed it to memory, but there are known terrorist training camps in the United States. I'm repeating.
And are you saying the government's allowing them to operate?
I'm saying that unless the government has shut him down, yeah, that they are allowing those to operate.
But you don't have any more details on it.
I just heard it in the media.
Somewhere.
I know they exist. I've heard it on. I've seen the report on mainstream media. I'm repeating the report from mainstream media. Yes.
So that's Curtis Coleman. I definitely don't think John Bozeman would say something like that. On the other hand, Curtis Coleman said he is very hesitant to commit ground troops to fight ISIS, although he does think we should destroy them. Anyway, so I looked that up a little bit, what he's talking about. I saw the Southern Poverty Law Center called this guy Martin Moyer, who's the head of the Christian Action Network. He published a book in 2013, and they started talking about this around 2009. And the only mainstream media outlet I could find that talked about this, which is a little surprising, is Coleman and Tea Partiers don't like the mainstream media generally, that he cite that as a reason. But Fox and Friends interviewed him when he came out with the book. I couldn't find any news network that claimed this was true, but Fox and Friends and a few people like that did interview this guy, so there's that. The other race you mentioned, the U.S. House race between Brock Ulrey and French Hill, not quite the same dynamic. French Hill is He's well known sort of for being a kind of level-headed guy. He likes to relax banking regulations, a former banker himself. He thinks that things like Dodd-Frank are really stifling the economy and, while intended to be helpful, are actually hurting smaller banks at the benefit of larger banks. But Brock Ulrey, on the other hand, I think he paid almost all of his campaign filing fee by himself. He's very little campaigning, doesn't really have an apparatus. He's never ran for office of any kind before. His big issue, to my surprise a little bit, was he really hates free trade deals. He thinks that they've been negotiated really unfairly. He even said that unions have a place in America. But anyway, so those are those two races. Pretty easy, looks like, for French Hill. I don't think I've seen any polling on this, but that's the race. So a number of state legislative contests that matter a lot, from things like Medicaid expansion that we talk about every week on this Week in Review podcast. You can find that and some of our stories from Sarah, Chris, and me, and Michael at KUAR.org. If you want to hear more about the elections, we have a tag and a little box at the top of the website that says something like election coverage, maybe 2016 on it. This has been another edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. We are editorially independent from UALR, though we love them very much. Our theme music is by Chris Hickey. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
And remember to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can check us out on the website as well, KUAR.org.